I'm Lillian Robinson. I'm the principal of the Simone de Beauvoir Institute at Concordia University. It's Concordia's Women's Studies program. So even if I were not myself Jewish, I might have a professional reason to be asking, who is the Jewish woman? And answer myself, what do you mean the Jewish woman? Jewish women. There are a lot of stereotypes of Jewish women. You know the joke that says, what's the plural of yenta?
Yes.
Right. Very good. Right. Step on my lines, why don't you? It's okay. You got the right answer. Right. I mean, that says something both about the fact that in North America, Jewish women have had a lot to do with holding the community together, both because the move on the part of immigrants centered more of Jewish identity in the home and in rituals in the home, and because Jewish women were able to take advantages of some of the opportunities, educational opportunities in particular, available in North America to enter public life. Which is not to say that, so you had public life and private life and public life, both centered around the Jewish women. And yet, there are these stereotypes. There's the Yenta. The Yenta we brought with us from the shtetl. She's still with us. This princess, who's new. And the community activism takes many, many forms. From the work that involves sort of traditional taking care within the Jewish community to activism in a way that involves fighting along with other people for justice, against racism, against war. The poster for this event has pictures of a number of women that some of us will claim as foremothers, women whose activism has run the gamut from legal reform, in the case of Justice Justine Wise Polier, who was the daughter of one of the major figures in Reform Judaism of the early part of the last century, to Emma Goldman, the well-known feminist, anarchist, and labor organizer, to, what was her name, Shore?
Denise
Shore, the French Jewish participant in the resistance.
We had a Rebetzin
in there?
Yeah.
Who?
Rebetzin.
She was
Weinberg.
Weinberg. Uh-huh. So, also when we speak about the Jewish community, we speak about a range of ethnicities and religious practices, from ultra-Orthodox to secular, with many stops in between, from European-born German-speaking, European-born Yiddish-speaking, European-born French-speaking, and the ethnicities that go with this, from including Ashkenazi and Sephardim of different sorts. And yet, on one question, people expect us as Jewish women, just as they expect all North American Jews, to have a single opinion. And we know what that question is. It's the question of the Middle East and support for Israel. Tonight, we have three speakers, Jewish women of different generations, who have all been to, worked in the Middle East in support of the struggle against the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. They don't have even the same lockstep politics with one another, much less with that of the politics that we are all as Jews expect to have. They're going to be speaking from both a personal and an experiential perspective about what they saw experienced did in the Middle East and what got them there in the first place. There'll be time for question and discussions afterwards. I'm going to introduce each one before she speaks. And we're going to begin with Helga Mankiewicz, whose family left Vienna with her a year before the Anschluss with Hitler, when she was 1 year old. They moved to New York, and she has, for a number of years, lived in Kingston, where she's retired from a job as a computer programmer. She's been active, to some extent, in other organizations, but her work with the International Solidarity Movement and on this issue is the first time, she tells me, that she has been completely absorbed in a political activity. And she was a volunteer with the International Solidarity Movement in Israel, demonstrating against the Israeli separation wall. So she'll tell us how she got there. Helga.
Well, thank you all for coming. I'm the oldest of the speakers tonight, so I get to go first. I'm actually older than the state of Israel. I was born in Austria in 1936 of Austrian parents, and who fortunately were able to get out of the country a year before the Anschluss. My father's sister wasn't so fortunate. She was killed by the Nazis in 1942. And my cousins and other aunt were wound up in Australia. My cousin through the kinder transport, and then was shipped out in the Dunera to a camp in Australia. He went to England and then Australia. So the family was split up. And both he and my father had stories to tell about the virulent anti-Semitism that they experienced in Austria. So I know how terrifying and humiliating and hurtful that can be. And I myself have experienced the milder forms of it in the US and Canada. I grew up in New York City, where there's a very large presence of Jews, and most of my friends were secular Jews like myself and my family. So I know the comfort and security of being in a community of one's own kind, where you don't have to worry about hurtful prejudices cropping up. But I never felt that an exclusively Jewish state was necessary for my protection, or that it made Jews any safer, or that I had to live exclusively among Jews. As I grew older, I associated with academics at university and people on the left who were concerned with social justice issues, and those people were always, I would say, against racism and jingoism, and I felt just as comfortable with them. And actually, many of those people were Jewish as well. So when I was 12, the State of Israel suddenly came into being, and at the time I think I was rather astonished that a people so recently weak and oppressed could miraculously achieve that result. I hoped the state would be a model of enlightenment and a light unto the world, as the saying goes, and that the values that I associated with being Jewish, like the wisdom, the compassion, and the justice, would have a greater scope than ever before. And I was proud of the positive achievements that I'd heard about, the kibbutz movement and the flowering of the Negev. And I hadn't heard anything about Palestinians, though. And for many years, in between going to university and working and raising a family, I was involved with other movements of the time, McCarthyism, civil rights for African Americans, the nuclear weapons issue, the Vietnam War, to name just a few. And I joined many peaceful protest marches and rallies and signed petitions, but I've never been as involved, as Lillian says, as I am with this issue of the occupation. For me, it was the first intifada that really woke me up to the plight of the Palestinians. much the way the civil rights movement had drawn people's attention to the long-standing injustice toward the African Americans. Like, we knew it existed, but somehow you can ignore it until the oppressed ones rise up themselves and speak out, and you can hear their voice. So around the start of the Second Intifada, I started to subscribe to an internet newsletter put out by an Israeli a peace group called Gush Shalom. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. And I was just horrified by the stories I'd read. They really put a human face on the suffering caused by the occupation. And here was they illustrated how this powerful state was using its monopoly of power to terrorize and bully and humiliate and impoverish virtually a whole isolated, defenseless people. I mean, it sounded familiar to me. Anyhow, but because I think it's because I'm Jewish that I felt particularly a strong sense of shame, and I didn't like what was being done in my name, and I felt I had to really do something. And I remember when the Palestinians asked for an international presence, for the UN to come in after the attack on the refugee camp at Jenin. I thought that was a very sensible idea, and was disappointed that nothing was done about it. And then I heard about the ISM, which is the International Solidarity Movement, which is a Palestinian-led organization that tries to get people to come to Palestine from all over the world and witness what's going on and sort of be a buffer between the Israeli military and the civilian population, particularly to allow them space to protest peacefully. And I stress peacefully because in the training that they give, it's very strongly emphasized that there's not to be any violence, just direct action to resist the occupation. And their presence, they bring in the media when possible, and just by their presence, they inhibit some of the brutality that would ordinarily be the fate of the civilians who are protesting. So last summer I went to with the ISM to Palestine, and stayed in a camp for about 3 weeks. Camping out in a farmer's field next to the fence. There's a fence in the countryside and a huge 8-foot concrete wall around some of the cities. I was with other activists, a small group of them, and both in the training sessions and in my group, I'd say about 30% of them were Jewish. And they were all like-minded people interested in social justice and very knowledgeable. And I had a great time associating with them. And the Palestinians, although I didn't speak Arabic, I heard many stories. When I went, there was a ceasefire had just taken place, so I didn't have to worry about being bombed on a bus or anything. Going to Jerusalem, and then in the West Bank, I felt perfectly safe, and we were very well treated by the Palestinians. They're very hospitable. They set up the camp for us, and very resourceful, got us everything we needed. We were quite comfortable, and there was a farmer across the way, gave us breakfast every morning, and they invited us to ceremonies and things in the village. And I didn't see any traces of anti-Semitism. I know that some of them knew we were Jewish, some of them never came up. And they didn't care. They were very appreciative of the presence of, you know, anybody interested in helping them. I heard a few stories from those who could speak a little bit of English. Many of them had relatives or friends or knew someone who was killed just for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. One man had a his infant daughter fell asleep after being sort of tear gassed, or getting a big whiff of tear gas, and never woke up again. We saw the effects of the roadblocks and the checkpoints. And for example, I heard about one village, Nazlat Issa, that couldn't get a pump fixed for the only well in the village, because it required heavy equipment to get it repaired. And all the roads to that village were blocked. And later on, I found out that the entire marketplace in that town of 60 shops or so had been demolished, ostensibly because they didn't have a permit for it. I went to several demonstrations against the wall. One of them, two of them, we were tear gassed and shot at with rubber bullets. And one of them was somewhat successful, the first one, in that, all along the fence there are these signs that say, mortal danger, military zone, any person who passes or damages the fence endangers his life. So it's very intimidating, and I was really surprised when we went on this march and the Palestinians went up to the fence and they shook it and broke the lock and got through the fence and started walking toward their fields. Their olive grove, which was on the other side, was separated from the village by the fence. They were separated from their olive grove. And the IDF came immediately. I don't know, they have got sensors on the fence and they can tell right away when someone's there. They came immediately, and there was a big discussion between the commander, who actually spoke Arabic, and some of the leaders. They were showing them that they had been given papers saying they could go through the fence to tend their crops, but they were told they had to apply individually for permission. And anyhow, after a big argument for about an hour, the soldiers pushed us back. But later on, it turned out that they decided to open the fence, and we could see on the other side from the camp, the other side of the fence, we could see them out in, on the hills amongst the olive trees, the Palestinians. But they can close the fence at any time, and very likely would if there were any other problems. So anyhow, and it was another demonstration in Jayus when we first got there, and I'll just read you the words of the head of the Land Defense Committee. His name is Sharif Omar. He said, "In Jayus, the Palestinian village on the West Bank that is my home, we began living with this problem last September." He's talking about the fence, I think. "When a shepherd found a paper hanging from an olive tree. It was a military order instructing us to meet an Israeli army officer to tour the separation wall's path. Hundreds of area Palestinians turned out. Most farmers expected that the wall would be near the Green Line, Israel's pre-1967 border with the West Bank. But we learned that the wall would be built almost 4 miles east of the Green Line, as close as 90 feet from Jayus's homes, separating our residential area from our farmland. People burst into tears. Some fainted. With the wall, Israel is taking 75% of Jayus's most fertile land, including all our irrigated farmland, 7 wells, and 12,000 olive trees. Jayus's 3,000 residents depend almost entirely on agricultural income, so this means the loss of our livelihoods, dreams, hopes, future, and heritage." And this is being repeated all over the occupied territories. I don't have the figures, but I guess you can read it on the Israeli human rights site, website of Bet Salem, how many tens of thousands of people are going to be trapped in between the wall and the Green Line. So they're non-citizens of any place, and how many people are separated from their families and their land and their jobs. And sometimes the walls being built right through a city like Abu Dis, I think, and just causing immense hardship for innocent people, really. I think the aim is just to drive them out. They're unwanted, and the land is wanted, but not the people. I think I'm probably...